Chris Boyd. Up next on Think, the cottage industry helping wealthy parents get their kids into elite universities by cheating and bribery. We'll spend this hour with Kevin Carey of New America discussing the scandal involving TV stars, fashion designers, and other powerful people conspiring to use bribery and fraud to secure places for their children in the freshman classes of highly selective schools. We're talking UT Austin, Georgetown, Stanford, Yale, and USC. We'll talk about the complicity of some university administrators and athletic coaches, about the deserving students who may have missed out on admission to make room for cheaters, and about whether the obsession with attending name-brand universities helped inspire these crimes. Our conversation starts after a short break.
Funding for the Think podcast comes from TCU, where researchers strive to develop sustainable solutions to protect the world's fresh water supply. You can learn more at endeavors.tcu.edu.
No question, there is a lot of pressure these days on high school students applying to top universities. Admissions officials scrutinize their test scores, their grades, their personal essays, and their extracurricular activities, and compare them to peers not just in their own state, but across the U.S. and around the world. Now we find out there's another way in for some wealthy students. Pay somebody smart to take the SAT, fudge personal bios to get an athletic scholarship so middling grades don't matter so much, or flat-out bribe university officials. And each of these cheaters takes the place of a student who played by the rules. From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. There's been lots of good reporting this week on the criminal complaint filed following an FBI investigation and on the famous people and their kids caught up in the dragnet. Today, I want to talk about why this happens, how we've built a society where some people assume that their money and access should buy them anything they want, including admission to schools that could be a ticket to upward mobility from students from less privileged or just more ethical families. Joining us to talk about this is Kevin Carey. He's Vice President for Education Policy and Knowledge Management at New America, and he often writes about education for publications including the New York Times, the Chronicle of Higher Education, and Wired Magazine. Kevin, welcome to Think.
It's great to be here.
First thing I want to ask you is, did this story surprise you, or was this kind of cheating an open secret?
I don't think it was an open secret, so it surprised me in that sense. I mean, it certainly... I wouldn't have thought so many athletic coaches at top universities would be so willing to just blatantly commit felonies and take large bribes in order to illegally facilitate college entrance. But it turns out that seems to be not uncommon.
So terms I heard for the first time in the context of this investigation were front door, back door, and side door college admissions. Are you able to just quickly explain what those terms mean?
Yeah, and I think that's really important context for this discussion. What the in the wiretaps that were part of the evidence that the FBI published this week, there's a transcript of the ringleader of this scheme explaining to one of his clients that there's a front door to getting into college, which is to actually get good grades and SAT scores. There's a back door, which is essentially the legal way that rich people bribe their way into colleges, which is to donate a lot of money directly to the college. And then what he said is, look, I've discovered a side door, which is to use the process by which coaches, often of minor sports, and minor I just mean not big-time revenue sports like basketball and football, are often allotted a certain number of slots each year to recruit students who may be very good at, say, tennis, but wouldn't otherwise qualify to get into the institution. Those are the coaches who received the bribes.
Why should there be special rules for the minimum academic standards for athletes?
Well, I think, are you asking why should athletes have to have minimum standards?
No, or? I'm saying why should athletes have different minimum standards than other students?
No, that's a great question. And I think it's a question that I imagine a lot of these universities are at least re-asking themselves in light of this terrible scandal. And this is actually a part of the admissions game that I think a lot of people don't understand. It's maybe well known, or people kind of realize that if you're a legacy, if your parents were alumni of the university, that helps you. That if you're extremely wealthy, there are strings to pull. And people probably understand, because they like to watch football and basketball on television, that there's a recruiting process for big-time sports athletes. But many, you know, these big universities will have dozens of sports teams. And for a variety of reasons, they actually set aside quite a few slots. They really want to have a winning sailing team, I guess. It's important to them, and they're willing to dilute the academic quality of their class to do it.
So lots of people have talked about the money generated by college sports, and I think it's not hard to look at a school that has a successful team and understand what that means. What do you know about how much of the money generated by big sports teams actually filters back to other students in the form of, academic aid or keeping tuitions down, that sort of thing?
It's hard to figure out. University finances are very complicated and very opaque, and they're presented in a way that's almost designed to make it difficult to answer questions like that. A lot of times universities will allege that they lose money on all of their sports programs, but these are nonprofit institutions, and so the whole idea of making money is a little different from the way they like to talk about themselves. I mean, so often, you know, we lose money on our football program that pays our coach $5 million a year. And that generates a great deal of attention for the university and gets alumni involved and engaged in all those things. I guess I would say if it was such a money loser, they probably wouldn't do it, and yet they do it.
It is an interesting choice. It sometimes, from my perspective, it looks like universities are just doing two different things. They're running these sports franchises and they are running an academic institution. I mean, theoretically, right, they could set up a chain of chicken restaurants and make money to support the university.
Sure. There's nothing preventing a nonprofit or even a public university from owning a for-profit business and using that money and not paying taxes on it. So there's a lot of flexibility. And you're right. And they don't really just do two things. They do probably 10 or 15 things. They are research enterprises. They're law schools, graduate schools. Many universities own hospitals. And also the big ones are running what essentially is a professional sports league in which the athletes don't get paid real money.
Can we believe the schools that say they had no idea that their coaches were breaking the rules with regard to getting low-performing students in?
I'm inclined to believe that. There's nothing that's good about this for the university. And I mean, you could argue a little cynically, perhaps, that what the coaches were doing was simply taking the donations that ought to have gone to the university to buy the kids into school. The normal process is you go to the development office and say, I'd like to give you $50 million to build a new wing on the hospital. And they put your name on the side. And then coincidentally, 2 years later, your son or daughter is admitted into the freshman class. Instead of getting the money that way, it went directly into the pockets of the coaches. So no, I don't think they had any idea. None of this is good for them.
So if they didn't know truly, should they have known? I mean, is it forgivable that this kind of thing can have gone on, as far as we can tell, for decades at some places?
Well, they clearly weren't checking to see if these young men and women actually enrolled in the sports, which would seem like a fairly easy thing to do. You know, if you get a list in 1 year that says, I want to give a tennis scholarship to these three women, and I'm just referring to the Georgetown women's tennis coach who was one of the people arrested this week, not that difficult to the next year see if they're actually on the tennis team or not. And if they're not, to ask questions, well, why did we give those admissions preferences? And apparently these universities were not doing that. And so they trusted their coaches too much.
So it's very strange that these parents who had tens or even hundreds of thousands of dollars available to buy their kids way into prestigious schools would do so. Like, it seems like young people from families this wealthy are least in need of the advantages conferred by a degree from a top school.
That's definitely true. I mean, there's actually some very good academic research by some, you know, really top-flight economists who have looked at this, and what they basically found is that for well-off students, there doesn't seem to be much of a return on going to a very selective college as opposed to the same student going to a less selective college. Where there is a difference, and this is where there's kind of an element of tragedy to this. It does make a difference if you're a first-generation and low-income student, whether you go to a very selective college or not. So really, what these lawbreakers were doing was paying bribes to give their children something their children didn't even really benefit from, and in doing so, take away something that someone else would have benefited from.
I mean, if we can believe the clips we've seen online, some of these kids didn't even want to go to these schools.
Or, and I mean, in some cases, it seems that the kids didn't know that this had happened. And there's in some of the cases, there are conversations taped between the, consultant, quote unquote, and the parents where they talk about, how do we, isn't my kid going to be surprised that their ACT score went from 23 to 32? Or I'm worried that they're going to get a note welcoming them to the football team when they don't play football. I don't know if victim is exactly the right word to describe students who benefited from this, but they seem to not have been willing participants in the scheme.
Hmm. All right. This whole ugly story also raises questions about how we came to view college attendance and where you attend college as a status symbol, right? Surely most of these students could have been accepted on their own merits somewhere, but their parents wanted them to have degrees from a name brand university as if it's a pair of designer jeans, and if I've got the money to pay for them, I should have them.
I think that's right. I mean, there was a quote from the, one of the people who was arrested was Lori Loughlin, the television star who paid $500,000 to get her two daughters into the University of Southern California by essentially pretending that they were members of the crew team. And there was a quote in the documents from her husband saying something to the effect of, we've got to do something so they don't have to just go to Arizona State. Arizona State's a really good public research university that's got a lot of very smart students there. The climate is nice. It's, they've got a great football team. There's nothing at all, quote, wrong. Not that I would say that there's anything wrong with going to any college. Mm-hmm. The level of kind of classism in this dialogue is pretty astounding. But the fact that they would use, a major public research university with a Division I football team as their example of where they don't want their daughters to go just shows in some ways kind of how deranged the mindset is that brings people to this place.
So let's talk about the deranged mindset. I mean, what do the rankings put out by, I guess the most notorious is U.S. News and World Report, but there are some other organizations that do that as well. How have the rankings changed the way we look at college?
My view on the rankings is that the rankings were, a very clever way of putting numbers to a status hierarchy that already existed. Hmm. It's not a coincidence that Harvard and Princeton and Stanford are always the highest ranked universities. Those are the universities that people inside higher education think are the best universities. There's not really any disconnect there. What the rankings did do was give other universities a way to climb the ladder. And actually USC, which appears to be the worst offender, there were four different people at USC that were arrested this week. Three coaches and an assistant athletic director. USC is a prime example of a university that used the U.S. News rankings as a way of building its prestige by increasing its selectivity, by raising a lot of money, by hiring well-known professors. And it really transformed itself from being, a university that was, known as kind of a second tier, particularly in relation to, say, UCLA, which has been a top flight research university for a long time, although UCLA also had a coach caught up this week, to now USC being seen as, much more in the vein of an NYU or even kind of in distance of some of the Ivy Leagues.
Hmm. When you talk about selectivity, this is also really interesting to me. I have four teenagers of college and just about college age, and we've gotten lots of those letters in the mail.
Yeah.
My kids have been recruited by schools that, based on their grades thus far and their SAT scores, are probably not really good fits for them, but we get letter after letter after letter. How seriously have schools tried to game the system by encouraging applications by students they pretty much know are not going to be accepted?
Well, the one of the fairly small number of hard measures that colleges make a point of publicizing is the percent of applicants they accept, which is another way of saying the percent of applicants they don't accept. Mm-hmm. And I think they may have finally calmed down on this in the last year or two. But for a while, you would get an email or a press release every year from Harvard and Stanford saying, we're proud to announce that this year we accepted 5.8% of students, which is the lowest acceptance rate in the history of the university. And they, I think, kind of eye one another to see who can get that number as low as possible. So, every person who applies who has no chance of getting in just makes that number better for them.
My guest is Kevin Carey. He's Vice President for Education Policy and Knowledge Management at New America. We're talking today about the cottage industry, or maybe I should say mansion industry, helping wealthy parents get their kids into elite universities by cheating and bribery. That was discovered this week and announced by the FBI. If you'd like to join our conversation, you can call us at 1-800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org, or you can find us on Twitter. We are at KERA Think. This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with Kevin Carey, who's Vice President for Education Policy and Knowledge Management at New America. We're talking this hour about this case revealed this week about the FBI investigation into wealthy parents cheating to help their kids get into elite universities, sometimes with the help of university athletic coaches. If you'd like to join our conversation, you can call 800-933-5372. Not to blame these elite universities necessarily for the fact that people have chosen to cheat to attend them, Kevin, but how feasible would it be for the top schools in this country, the ones that people are just desperate to attend, to expand their student bodies by a certain percentage?
I mean, it would be, if you ask them, they would say it would be very expensive and difficult, but I think that's an excuse and kind of represents a lack of imagination, but most fundamentally a preference. I'm pretty sure Harvard has not increased the size of its freshman class since the early 1990s. A few institutions like Yale and Princeton are putting some money into building new dorms, but even then, they're expanding at a very incremental level. Look, these are institutions that like being exclusive. They prefer to be seen as the places that are very hard to get into. They enjoy the reputation of being only for the best of the best. They have no real incentive to change that.
Is there evidence that similarly talented and motivated students who attend like mid-tier universities have life outcomes that are worse than their peers who attend top-tier schools?
There are some different research findings on this. There was one that I referred to a little earlier that looked at students, the difference between going to a very selective school and a somewhat less selective school, and it found little differences. Except for low-income and minority students. There was another study done a few years ago that looked at a flagship public university and compared similar students who had gone to the flagship public university to less selective public institutions in the state. There they did find a difference, a return of about 20% in terms of lifetime earnings or long-term earnings from going to the flagship public university. And there's also probably, and this is a little hard to pick up in the research, but at the very elite institutions, I think there are some somewhat narrow but real pathways into, say, investment banking or the elite levels of law that kind of do run through the Ivies in a few schools, maybe also in the sciences. Some of the, Caltech or MIT. I mean, I think it makes a difference if you go to someplace like that, depending on what you want to study. But these are exceptions, really, to a broader set of rules.
Americans seem to agree that college acceptance should be based solely on merit. I wonder how what you can tell us about how university admissions offices define merit.
It's a very broad term, and it's defined in a very broad way. And yeah, I do think that, I mean, there is definitely a strong element of the American character that sees this as a country of opportunity, of meritocracy, of a place where people from all kinds of backgrounds get a fair shake and can earn their way to what they deserve, and that the increasingly our higher education system is the venue for doing that, and therefore it should reflect those values. Admissions people have a lot of things they're trying to accomplish at once. They want a diverse student class in a lot of different ways. They want academically well-qualified students. They want students who are good at different things, not just academics, but art and music and sports. And they want people from lots of different kinds of backgrounds, but they also want people who can pay the bills, either in the form of the tuition they pay or in the form of the donations that their parents give. And so it's a very complicated mix. It's a balancing act, really, as any admissions officer, I think, could tell you.
It's important to note that plenty of kids from wealthy families get into good colleges on their own merits and are being raised by parents who would not dream of cheating, right, to let them in.
Yes.
There is this enormous irony in comparing students whose parents would pay any amount of money to get them in to their target school when so many other students leave college deep in debt. Would it make sense for colleges to be more open about the backdoor way in by which parents or grandparents or somebody makes a huge donation? You know, carve out a certain number of spots in every class for wealthy students, auction those off to the highest bidder, and use that money to offset tuition costs for everybody else.
I mean, I think that would be a more honest way of doing what they're essentially already doing now. They would just be more upfront about it. But, you know, that would really fly against the self-image and the public interest that image that these institutions work very, very hard to maintain. They really have put themselves in a position of being able to have it all, to be seen as institutions of integrity, institutions with high academic standards, and yet also very much benefit from being a part of the organized power structure, which is where they've been that much longer than they've been places that enroll students only with high SAT scores. You know, for many, many years, Harvard, for example, decades, centuries, was a place where actually not very academically gifted young men who were from the East Coast upper class went to college, period. You know, there was no, everyone understood that that's what they were all about. And they are still kind of about that. There are vestiges of those systems and structures that these colleges still want to participate in at the same time that they're seen as virtuous in all these ways.
All right, let's go to the phones. Our number is 800-933-5372. First up, we have Sarah Beth on the line in San Antonio. Hi, Sarah Beth.
Hi there. How are you?
Very well, thanks.
I am a sociologist, and I often start my semester talking about college admissions with my students. There's a sociologist named Jerome Crable who wrote a history called The Chosen about getting into college. And really interestingly, this whole notion of the well-rounded student or the athletic student began in this country as part of a strategy to secure admissions for especially privileged people. And this is beginning in the 1920s. Jews, interestingly, were getting into Harvard and Yale and Princeton in numbers that college admissions folks thought was not good for their reputation. They didn't want a school full of Jews who they perceived to be kind of a weaker exemplar. And this is when the idea of admitting people based on things other than their scholastic merit started. So the idea of having athletes in college is, in fact, rooted in this exclusionary policy.
Well, what about that, Kevin?
Well, that's exactly right. It's a great book, The Chosen, and it is remarkable how explicit some of the people were in talking. They referred to Jewish students as greasy grinds, I believe, that they just didn't want anywhere near the purer, more virtuous students that they were used to seeing around campus. And so, yes, absolutely right. They invented this idea of the well-rounded student, put a lot of stock in very vague ideas like leadership, or even literally the way men, because these were only men, looked, their bearing, their athletic ability. But it was all kind of backward engineered to make sure that the people who had power and privilege kept it. And, you know, again, I don't think that our elite schools have entirely rid themselves of that mindset or that approach. Which, you know, in a lot of ways kind of brings us to these issues that we're dealing with now.
So legacy admissions have come up a couple of times in this conversation. They weren't part of this investigation, but a legacy admission is when you get a little extra consideration because you have a close relative who's already attended a school. Do legacies get preference because the assumption is a family that is a dyed-in-the-wool, whatever, Princeton family is likely to give more money?
It depends on the school. It's pretty clear that rich legacies count for a lot more than not rich legacies. So the real sweet spot is to be both a legacy and a donor at the same time. And the development offices in these schools pay close attention to this. Really, the definitive book on this subject, was written about 10 years ago by an investigative journalist named Dan Golden.
Right.
It's called The Price of Admissions. It's a fantastic book. Nothing in it was really refuted. He exposed all of these things back then, the athletic preferences, the preferences for donors, and his prime example, actually, of preferences for donors, which no one really knew at the time how meaningful it would become, was that a young man named Jared Kushner's father had donated $2.5 million to Harvard shortly before Kushner, who no one in his private high school thought was good enough to get into Harvard, somehow got in. Which was just kind of a funny side story then and is a little less funny now, I suppose. This is all very well known, kind of this whole system. It's been in place for a long time.
Dan Golden has been dismayed to discover that people apparently used his work of investigative journalism as a how-to guide, how to cheat.
It doesn't surprise me at all, and I wouldn't actually be surprised if one consequence of this scandal is the same thing happening, that there are people out there who say, oh, hey, I didn't know that I could pay bribes if I could just find someone who's a little more discreet about it. Because, you know, one thing that is pretty clear is that one benefit of going through this bribe system is that there was a huge discount compared to what you have to pay the university directly. There was, I think, it was a good article in the New York Times yesterday quoting a few people who are doing legal college consulting. And the consensus was that $10 million is just enough to get you in the door. Not enough by itself, but if you even want to have a serious conversation with a top flight university that might result in some preference for your children, you start at $10 million and go up from there. I think the biggest bribe anybody paid to the person who was arrested was $1.2 million. I think Lori Loughlin paid $500,000 to get her two daughters into USC, which is partly just the market rate, I suppose. USC doesn't cost as much to bribe your way into as Stanford does.
What's your sense of the fallout for middle-class families who are already feeling squeezed, who are already putting just tremendous amounts of pressure on their kids to get into good colleges? Now, I can imagine there are lots of people out there who have read this and thought, oh, no, my kid needs to work even harder and you know, do 12 hours of homework a day, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, because we can't possibly compete with a $500,000 payment to a coach or whatever.
Well, I think it will probably inevitably and deservedly breed a lot of cynicism among people, and understandably so, but it's a shame because one thing we know is that there are a lot of highly qualified, lower-income students who don't even apply to top schools because they think there's no way they could ever afford to go there, not realizing that the very, very well-off schools actually provide very generous financial aid to low-income students. They tend to not admit that many of them, but those that they admit, if you can get into Harvard, it's cheaper to go to Harvard than it is to go to a public university because Harvard is free if you're from a low-income family. But they never apply because it just never occurs to them that the world could work that way. And I think this will just reinforce that idea.
This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. All right, back to the phones now. We have Stephen on the line in Austin. Hi, Stephen.
Yes, thank you. Earlier in the show, you mentioned the overlap of this issue with athletic recruiting and how they exploited athletic recruiting with this scam. You know, but I graduated from both Yale and the University of Texas at Austin, and both universities chose to say, in this case, that they were victims of a crime. But it seems to be very similar to the kind of deniability we hear when other types of scandals are revealed with athletics. So my question is whether or not in Division I universities, administration has completely ceded control of its athletic department or doesn't have control of its athletic department when it comes to issues like this.
Thanks for calling.
I think that's a great point. And there definitely seems to be an overlap in terms of the culture of deference to athletics. Again, the university that had the biggest impact was at USC. Four different people charged this week. I think at every other university it was only one. USC has a lot of great students and great scholars. It's a serious institution, but it is also an institution with a huge culture of alumni who care an awful lot about that football team and just all of the different sports that people play. And when there's that much money and psychic energy at play, just all kinds of things happen in terms of who is deferred to, who is trusted, who is given resources, who questions are not asked about. And I think that this bribery scandal really reflects that.
What is college for?
It's for different things for different people. For most students, if you ask them, why are you going to college? They will overwhelmingly give you the same answer, which is, I want to get a credential that allows me to get a better job. Mm-hmm. People know that in the modern economy, it's very difficult to earn a middle-class living unless you have some kind of college credential. That doesn't mean a four-year degree. It could mean a two-year degree. It could mean a certificate in some kind of vocational field. But you need to get something if you want to get on some kind of career path that leads to higher earnings and a decent lifestyle for your family. You know, college also ought to mean, particularly four-year college, ought to mean not just, it should mean learning how to live. It should be exposing yourself to different perspectives. It should be finding new ways and new tools to understand the world, things that will stay with you even as the world changes around you. College also means status. And I think it's hard to overestimate how important a role that probably played in this scandal. I think there are a lot of affluent communities where among parents, the quality of the college that your child goes to is the single most important indicator of your status and your success or failure as a parent. And that drives people to do kind of unimaginable things.
It is interesting that the parents of this generation, and maybe you think it's always been this way, but really seem to define, as you say, their success or failure as a parent on where their kids end up going to school. I don't know that that's always been the case, that parents felt they had failed if their kids didn't get into an Ivy League school.
I think that's right. You know, I think if you look at the history of American higher education, there was definitely a real pivot in, you know, starting in the 1970s and going into the 1980s, where it became much more of a national market, where all of the selective colleges started to become more selective and compete with one another. I mean, you know, this is only a few years after the elite schools started letting in women, and only maybe 10 or 20 years after they started discriminating against Jews and Catholics and people of other religions. So you know, the parents of college-age children now are really the first generation of a sort of college meritocracy, where they grew up in a time where going to a good school was de rigueur, going to a good school was the only path to achievement. You know, the sort of solidification of the kind of meritocratic ruling class in the United States. That's this generation of parents phenomenon. And so it doesn't surprise me that those values are reflected in how they see their children.
Kevin Carey is my guest. He's Vice President for Education Policy and Knowledge Management at New America. We're talking about this scandal involving wealthy parents helping their kids get into elite universities by cheating and bribery. You can join us at 800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with Kevin Carey, Vice President for Education Policy and Knowledge Management at New America. We're talking about the scandal in which wealthy parents were caught helping their kids into elite universities by cheating and bribery. I want to go back to the phones now. We have Allie on the line in Fort Worth. Hi, Allie.
Hi.
Hi, go right ahead.
Well, I want to ask a question. I'm both a public school teacher of predominantly students of color, mm-hmm. but also I'm a graduate of two Ivy League schools where I was a student of color. And my experience as a student is that I had people tell me to my face that the only reason I was there was as a token minority.
Wow.
And my experience as a teacher is that, you know, I had a very positive experience overall despite those comments at those schools, and I want the best for my students. You know, locally, I'm an alumni interviewer. On the off chance that any of my students want to apply. And it just, I just can't wrap my mind around the fact that, you know, with all of these hand-wringing pieces about affirmative action, there was so much discussion on whether students of color deserve their spot, whether they're taking a spot, you know, whether they can hack it there. And then the reality is that the system is completely rigged and nobody seems to question the presence of students who, you know, patently don't play the sports that they're admitted for, you know, and that just deeply bothers me, both as an alumna and a, you know, a teacher and somebody who just wants a fair, you know, playing field for kids.
Well, I can certainly understand your frustration, Ellie, and I'm really glad you called with that perspective. What do you have to say about all that, Kevin? I have heard some people calling this cheating scam like affirmative action for dumb white kids.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's been one thing I've certainly noticed in seeing a lot of the reaction on social media and out where is stories just exactly like the one we heard from Allie, from people of color who were, you know, blatantly confronted during their own college careers by people who said, oh, well, you don't deserve to be here, obviously, because of the color of your skin. So many problems with that. First of all, the large majority of people of color in elite schools were not the beneficiaries of affirmative action. Those that were affirmative action and preferences based on race are only part of a larger package of things. And there are an awful lot of good educational and social reasonings for those policies that universities embrace. And yet we are now in a situation where the United States Supreme Court may decide that out of all of the various admissions preferences that colleges indulge in, and keep in mind that allowing rich people to write large checks to get their kids in is legal and happens all the time. It's just this way was illegal, but there's a very legal way of doing that. That's fine. You know, preferences for rich people is fine. Preferences for legacies are fine. Preferences for celebrities are fine. All of which, preferences for people who are good at sports that basically are only populated by people of means. One of the people who took a bribe during the scandal was the coach of the Stanford University sailing team. How many people can afford to be good at sailing? or even know that if they get their kids good at sailing, that's the side door into Stanford? Very few. And I think we know what kind of people those are. So the fact that that would be all okay, but somehow affirmative action, which is designed to both make the educational experience better through more diverse students and to provide an opportunity to people who often are denied that opportunity basically every other step of the way through their K-12 system, that one kind of preference is unconstitutional, that seems pretty amazing to me.
So the other thing about this whole scandal is that let's assume that, you know, these parents have been getting their kids into these elite schools who didn't earn their way there with grades and merit. One would either expect these young people to flame out. And if they don't flame out, maybe it's time for universities to rethink the criteria they used to select students in the first place.
Yeah, I mean, there is a fiction behind the way that universities like to talk about their admissions criteria, where they will say, you know, we set these standards and that, you know, the implication is that only students who get in are smart enough to do well.
Mm-hmm.
That is not true. First of all, there's all kinds of different ways that you can engage with a university. You can take hard classes, you can take easy classes. And the fact that they already lower their admission standards for athletes who presumably go on to take the classes like everyone else just goes to show that that's not true. You know, this sense that our academic standards are so high, their standards for what SAT scores are looking for may be high, but, you know, at many elite schools, the most common grade given out is an A. It's actually very hard to fail out of Harvard. Almost no one does it, even though Harvard students are not uniformly brilliant. They don't all make good choices. They do a lot of the same dumb things that college students do, and yet they all seem to graduate.
Yeah, I read that, you know, Jared Kushner's defenders have pointed out that he graduated with honors, and then I read that 90% of his graduating class graduated with honors.
Yeah, that says it all.
Yeah. All right. Let's go back to the phones. We have Linda calling from Dallas. Hi, Linda.
Hi. So kind of along the lines of what you were just discussing, I wanted to know if Kevin had any information in terms of what it takes to keep a student in school once you've bribed their way in. I'm in Dallas, and as a personal assistant to some of Dallas's elite families, I've been put in positions where I've had to take cash to people on campus for reasons that were not disclosed to me, but I could only assume meant to help with grades or also to help with behavioral issues through the college private police department to get some child out of a situation that would have ultimately resulted in their removal from the school.
I don't think there's any question that universities know where their bread is buttered. And the process of deference to children of politicians, children of wealthy alumni, children of athletic boosters doesn't stop at the point when those children are let into school, even though they may not be qualified to get in. It extends while they're in school. And, you know, there's a lot of reasons why they want to keep everything in the family and make sure that their patrons get everything that their patrons think they're deserved. And sometimes that means exactly the kinds of preferences that you've just described.
What kind of soul searching do you think is happening on college campuses this week?
Well, I'm not sure there's a lot of soul searching going on. I mean, I imagine every university president with a robust sports program and a selective admissions criteria is taking a hard look at all of the athletic coaches and wondering whether or not that all of a sudden those are people who are a kind of vulnerability to the university that they might not have seen before. Maybe they're going to start to go back and do an audit and see how many of the students who were admitted because of these preferences actually showed up on the court the next fall or the playing field. So I think that's a start. And I think just from a practical matter, they'll think about that. I don't know that they'll really reconsider the values that drive the way that they think about money and admissions, because again, these bribes were just an illegal version of a system that already existed and has already been around a long time.
Is there any reasonable way for students who believe they were denied admission to these universities to make room for students who got in by cheating to claim some recourse?
I mean, actually, a couple hours ago, somebody filed a class action lawsuit, although strangely, it was a couple of Stanford students, people who got into Stanford, who I didn't have a chance to read the complaint before we started the show today, but appear to have trying to be claiming a legal class that the value of their degree has been degraded by the implication that you could bribe your way in, even though Stanford actually didn't admit either of the people that paid the bribes to the sailing coach, or that they lost the opportunity to go to Yale or USC. No slam on USC, at least for this reason, but most people who get into Stanford and USC tend to pick Stanford. It's a little higher up in the pecking order. Yale is probably on the same level. So it's a little weird that they're the ones who would think of that, but probably more to follow.
All right, let's go back to the phones. Courtney is on the line in Houston. Hey, Courtney.
Hi, how are you?
Very well, thanks.
My question is, and I really wanted to pick your brain, Kevin, about, I've been thinking a lot back from my childhood and watching TV, and there's some child actors that have spent their entire childhood and teenagehood on sitcoms or throughout Hollywood and doing, the tutor on set, having their timed education. And it made me wonder, is that a flag on how were they able to pass the SAT and the ACT with such little education and be able to get into Yale and Harvard and all these amazing schools?
This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. What do you know about that, Kevin?
Well, it's a good question. I mean, there are lots of different ways you can learn, and maybe tutors are good. I mean, one thing we haven't discussed as much is that there were really two parts to this scandal. One was the bribes to the athletic coaches, but the other was actually just outright cheating on the SAT and ACT, where they orchestrated a process where literally somebody else would take the exam. I believe a Harvard graduate would take the test for the students. And so they submitted fraudulent test scores. It's also the case, frankly, that universities kind of like having celebrities on campus. It's cool for them. They're as susceptible to the attractions of fame as anyone. And I think if a famous name turns 18 and decides that he or she wants to come to campus, I imagine that weighs pretty heavily when they, you know, do their, quote, holistic review of the application.
So our culture says that good parents do whatever it takes to help their children succeed. I think most of us understand that that doesn't mean cheating, but regardless, it is interesting that, like, when another student, an invisible student from a less affluent family, is directly harmed by some of this activity, can you think of a way that we could help people comprehend that cheating is not a victimless crime?
Yeah, I mean, that's really the nefarious thing about that is that now we see the public face of the people who cheated. What we don't see are the faces of the people whose spots were taken. The universities have said we're the victims here, but really the victims were the people who didn't get a chance to go to the place that they deserved. We don't know who they are, but they're out there somewhere. There's a callousness and a level of indifference to that really is pretty appalling when we think about the way that not only the choices that were made, but in some of the ways that people talked about this as if, of course, if you have an opportunity to lie, cheat, and steal on behalf of your child, you'll do it. It doesn't speak well to the character of anyone involved.
What advice would you give parents who feel like their kids should have performed well enough to be accepted to a name brand school but didn't?
Don't give in to cynicism. The entire system doesn't work this way. There are plenty of opportunities for your son or daughter to go to a very good institution. But also don't get too caught up in the hype around these super selective institutions. The idea that you have to, if you don't get into a super selective expensive school, pathways of opportunity are cut off for you. It's not true. Trust me, I went to a good state university in New York and then went to graduate school at another state university in Ohio. I get to come and be on your great radio show all day as part of my job. I write for the New York Times. I work with lots of people in Washington who went to these schools. I work with lots of people who don't. The good people come from all places. So it's not the end of the world if you can't find your way into this tiny number of institutions.
Do you think that we should be cautious about automatically assuming that a student who comes and applies for a job from one of these elite universities is better than someone like you or like me that didn't necessarily go to an Ivy League?
Oh, sure. I mean, I hire people all the time. And if I did that, I would be bad at my job.
Mm-hmm.
I conduct interviews for people. And routinely, the best candidate is not someone who went to one of these schools. It's not a guarantee. And again, as we've learned, because the system is so tries to do so many things, lots and lots of people attend elite schools not because they necessarily were the smartest or the hardest working. So we shouldn't assume that anybody, and that was true before this week, we shouldn't assume that anyone who walks out with a degree from one of these institutions is automatically somehow super qualified.
So our education should teach us to look at things critically.
Absolutely.
Kevin Gary is Vice President for Education Policy and Knowledge Management at New America. He does a lot of writing for the New York Times and the Chronicle of Higher Education. Kevin, thanks so much for making time for us today. I really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me. It's been great.
You can follow us on Twitter at KERA Think, and you can subscribe to our podcast using any podcast app that you are familiar with. Check our website, think.kera.org, to see what we have planned for upcoming days of the show. Again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.